I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Congressional Budget Office released a report this week that examined after-tax household incomes between 1979 and 2007, and the results are eye-popping. The wealthiest 1% saw their household incomes increase by 275%. The income for others in the top 20% increased 65% over those years. The majority of Americans, 60% of middle-class households, experienced growth of almost 40% during that time. Low-income households fared the worst. Their incomes rose just 18%. Well, here to make sense of some of these numbers is Paul Taylor. He's the executive vice president of the Pew Research Center, serves as the director of the center's Social and Demographic Trends Project, also director of the Pew Hispanic Center. And Paul Taylor, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And I know that you've been following these numbers. Do they shock you?
Well, they don't shock people who have been following them, and my guess is, frankly, they don't shock most Americans because they live them. This looks over nearly 30 years' worth of data, and it says, measured by income, we have become a more unequal society. The people at the top have done extremely well. The people in the middle and at the bottom, less so. And people have lived that, and they know it. And I think some of the turbulence in our economy, some of the Occupy Wall Street movement, some of the difficulties that Congress is having figuring out what to do with the deficit and the debt are all based on these realities.
And I notice this report ends at 2007, really before the recession hurt. Is there any way to know whether this disparity is even bigger today?
I would think it is, and there is certainly you could look at certain data over the last 4 years and see that these trends are continuing and perhaps even accelerating. But I think it is very useful to have the longer term perspective. In living memory, you can go back 50 or 60 years. There was about a 25-year period after World War II where this country experienced great prosperity, vast improvement in standard of living through the 50s, the 60s, and into the early 70s. And while this was happening, there was actually wage and standard of living convergence. That is to say, everybody benefited. The economy grew at very rapid rates, but the poor and the middle class actually did a little bit better relative to those at the upper end of the income scale. In the last 25 or 30 years, this next period that we're in now, and that this report talks about, the trends have gotten more difficult in two senses. First, there's less year-to-year growth in overall standard of living, but there is still some. And to the extent that there is growth, most of the benefits of that growth are going to the folks at the top.
And when we're talking about the folks at the top, that 1%, what kind of household incomes are we talking about here?
Well, I think at 1%, I think you're up into the probably $300,000-$500,000 range. What's really interesting is that if you look at the top 1%, well, you can do it any number of ways. If you look at the top 10%, they're running away from the bottom 90%. Then if you look at the top 1% in terms of their overall gains, they're running away from the top 10%. Mm-hmm. Then if you look at the top 0.1%, they're running away from the top 1%. One of the points that this report makes is there is a kind of winner-take-all aspect to our economy where the rewards at the very, very, very tippy top are extraordinary. You see that in executive compensation and other markers. So that skews some of these numbers. It doesn't change the experiences of the vast numbers of Americans who are living in the middle of the income curve. But, you know, in some ways, it does provide maybe a context. One of the things that I think, you know, the Pew Research Center does a lot of survey research, and we look at people's attitudes towards how well they are doing. It's a hard question for people to answer because you can answer it objectively. Do I have the same sort of things that my parents had when they were my age? Do I live in as nice a house? Do I have as nice a car? Do I have the material things that are, you know, am I able to afford to get my kids through college? And on a lot of those measures, actually, most people are doing better, or they recognize that they're doing better than their parents. But then when they also look at at the very wealthy and the great successes that people are having at the very top, it doesn't feel like they're doing better. So there's an absolute measure and there's a relative measure, and it's complicated for people to work through.
And that's Paul Taylor, Executive Vice President of the Pew Research Center, talking about some of these CBO numbers that that were published this week. The first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Any calls or any questions you might have, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to move beyond the 1%, but I'm trying to understand, are they just making so much more money, or are they paying less in taxes? Of course, knowing that they pay a lot in income taxes compared to the rest of the country, are we treating the kind of income that they make differently than an income that someone might make on an assembly line?
Well, that's a complicated question,
and
it's beyond my expertise. It's
okay.
Part of the debate that's going on now, and as you know, Warren Buffett, one of the most famously rich men in the country, has said it's a crying shame that he pays less marginal tax rate than the secretary who works for him. That may be the case. I think the tax code is enormously complicated. Overall, the very wealthy in this country have more wealth and more income relative to everybody else than they have had, and as a result of that, they are also paying more taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But whether or not their taxes have risen as fast as their wealth and their income is a matter, frankly, beyond my ability to dissect, but I suspect it'll be a matter for a lot of conversation as we look at the tax code in the coming years.
But looking even at three-fifths of the public, this is the 60% of Americans in the middle, their income increase a little bit less than 40% over this time period. I did a little mathematical calculations. That's about 1.5% a year. Does that keep up with inflation?
Well, no, these are all inflation-adjusted numbers. So those are real increases,
okay.
And that gets to a point I made earlier, that if you look over the past 30 or 40 years, life and standard of living is continuing to get better for those in the middle, even though it doesn't feel that way. And I think part of the reason it doesn't feel that way is it's gotten so much better for people at the top. But you should also note that in the last decade, there has been no growth, and indeed there has been a slight decline in standard of living or annual income for people in the middle. And this is the longest stretch in modern economic history. You have to go back to the Great Depression to have a decade where median household income has not increased for a decade. So we are in a very flat economy. We're officially, quote-unquote, out of the recession, but in the lives of most Americans, that hasn't happened yet. And I think you see it reflected in sort of frankly, some of it you see reflected in the fact people aren't spending because mm-hmm. they don't have much confidence in the economy. They know their circumstances are difficult, and it's sort of a self-perpetuating cycle.
The Pew Research Center did some research over the summer looking at the wealth gap, comparing whites, blacks, and Hispanics, and finding that white household wealth was 20 times black household wealth and 18 times Hispanic household wealth. Can you expand on that?
Sure, but first let's make sure we understand the distinctions.
Okay.
Income is a measure of annual flow, how much money comes into your family or your household. Wealth is a measure of stock. It's all the things you own, your house, your car, your financial assets, your 401k, whatever it may be, et cetera, minus all the things you owe, your home mortgage, your car loan, your student loan, your credit card debt, et cetera. And the story of income inequality that we've just talked about mm-hmm. is mirrored in the story of growing wealth inequality. And there are a lot of different ways to look at the growth in wealth inequality. One of the ways we looked at it was through the lens of racial groups. And what we found is that as of 2009, the last year for which we could get these statistics, the typical black household in this country had about $6,000 worth of wealth. The typical Hispanic household had a little over $6,000 worth of wealth, and the typical white household had $113,000 worth of wealth. So these are ratios of about 20 to 1 between whites and blacks and whites and Hispanics, and that's about double the ratios that had prevailed between these groups for the 25 years preceding the recession of the last 4 years. The story we're able to tell, because we also took a snapshot of wealth just before the onset of the recession, is that while the recession hurt everybody in different ways, it actually hit the minority communities much harder. For most families, the biggest piece of their wealth is the home they own, and we all know what's happened to the housing market. Again, it's hurt everybody, but disproportionately, it hurt minority communities and wiped out, in many cases, what few assets they had. So this is going to be a setback for a lot of people that presumably it will take them a long time to recover from.
And you also found among Hispanic and Black households that about 24%, about a quarter of them, had no assets whatsoever.
Actually, the numbers are a little bit higher.
More than that.
Of 2009, 35% of Black households and 31% of Hispanic households had either zero or negative net worth. In other words, they had debts that were greater than their assets.
Did you look at Asian households?
We did, and the story there is much better. Asian households and Asian income are at a par with, or depending on the year you look at and the metric you look at, either equal to or greater than white households.
We have about 2 minutes before we have to say goodbye here, but I'm not an economist, but it seems to me one must worry if we have a country where we have this growing income divide and even a divide among wealthy people, but a middle class that, while they might be better off than their parents, don't have a kind of confidence in the future and do feel squeezed by this economy.
Well, I think we're living the worry right now. I think some of the polarization in our politics, some of the sense of paralysis in Washington, how do we solve some of these problems? They're not necessarily expressed in these terms, but they're expressed in the terms of what do we do about deficits and debt? What do we do about our entitlements? What do we do about taxes? These are difficult choices in any circumstance, but now we have a kind of we're facing a kind of politics of subtraction, where the demographics are such that our country's getting older. The claims on Social Security and Medicare are going to grow as the baby boomers age into the group that receives these benefits. The economy is not growing as fast as it has in the past, and people are hurting in their pocketbooks. I don't think the worry is off in the distance. I think the worry is upon us now. And I think, frankly, as a society, these are challenges we're not going to spend the next year or two. We're going to spend the next decade or two facing up to, and there are going to be a bunch of difficult choices.
Well, indeed. And I thank you, Paul Taylor, for getting our conversation started and for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And Paul Taylor is Executive Vice President of the Pew Research Center and serves as the Director of the Center's Social and Demographic Trends Project, Director of the Pew Hispanic Center as well, and joined us in this first portion of Radio Times talking about the CBO report released this week about the widening income gap between the very wealthy and most of the rest of the country. And the Pew Research Center has been doing some related research on income and wealth and assets. We've got Wayne Slater from the Dallas Morning News weighing in the wings, and he's going to weigh in on politics, Texas style, especially presidential candidate Rick Perry. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation supports WHYY and invites the entire community to submit their best ideas for the arts to the Knight Arts Challenge Philadelphia by the October 31st deadline. The challenge is a 3-year, $9 million initiative to fund arts ideas that engage and enrich Philadelphia's communities. The contest is open to anyone, including artists, businesses, organizations, and individuals. Information and the 150-word application is available at knightarts.org.
Picky eaters, hectic schedules, rising grocery prices. Many families struggle to make meals that fit their budgets, tastes, and lives, and are healthy to boot. I'm Mike and Scott. Join us for the next WHYY Parenting Seminar, when we'll discuss healthy nutrition for kids and families. We'll also talk about cooking with children. Tuesday, November 8th at 6:30 here at WHYY. To register, visit whyy.org/member experience.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY and presents an exhibition with an original live theater performance, Fighting for Democracy, Who is the We in We the People? The real-life struggles and triumphs of seven diverse citizens who fought for freedom and justice during World War II. Compelling stories come to life from ordinary people with extraordinary legacies. At the National Constitution Center now through January 16th. Tickets at constitutioncenter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. When Texas Governor Rick Perry entered the GOP presidential race this summer, he enjoyed some popularity for a few weeks. After some clumsy and lackluster debate performances, his poll numbers took a tumble. He released a flat tax proposal this week, revived the birther issue, and raised questions about future participation in upcoming debates. We asked Wayne Slater, senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, to join us on Radio Times to talk about politics. Texas style, and to talk about Governor Rick Perry. Wayne, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're curious if you've been following the Rick Perry campaign, what you make of it. And I'm curious, Wayne, what Texans are making of the Rick Perry campaign. He's never lost an election in Texas, but he is struggling on the national stage. What's been the response in your state?
Well, I think Rick Perry, truthfully, has never been an extraordinarily popular governor, unlike George Bush and Ann Richards, John Connally. But he's been popular enough, and he really has been, it sort of demonstrated the sort of Texas ethos, which was enough to get elected, as you've said, in every statewide election and his legislative seat for the last 25 years. He's a good campaigner. He really is a great match for Texas. I'm not sure he's a very good match for anywhere else.
Well, I'm curious, why isn't he so popular in Texas?
Well, I think what he has done is he has run a state in a very increasingly partisan way. Now, again, he won. He has won re-election three times in Texas, so he is more popular than the alternatives. He's also sort of managed a state that in large part is built around favors, that is to say, and a lot of people are that way. I mean, it's Chicago politics, to be honest with you, where, you know, if you've made campaign contribution to the governor, and in Texas there are no limits. If you want to give the governor $1 million, and some people do, then that's fine, as long as you report it. But those people get favors. They get state agencies created for them. They get appointments on boards and commissions and so forth. Now, that would be a problem if the state economy were really bad, or if there were other problems that normal citizens, I think, in their own lives saw that and blame Perry for. But the truth is, the Texas economy, as the governor points out, has been really darn good over the last decade, and has been relatively good, remains relatively good, in large part because of the energy industry here, in the last couple of years, which have been difficult for everybody.
I noticed that while his poll numbers have dropped, he did raise something like $17 million. So someone is supporting his campaign.
Well, 60% of that money came from Texas. These are sort of the beginning folks. A lot of money from California, some money from Florida, from Georgia. Interestingly, very little money from New York and Wall Street. That money, to the extent that it is dispensed so far, is going to Mitt Romney. Now, this is the low-hanging fruit. The question is, how will Perry do in the next quarter, the current quarter that we're in fundraising? But he's got a lot of money, and their plan is to spend a lot of that money between now and through January in order to make an impression in Iowa and in South Carolina. That's their line of demarcation. If he can do okay in Iowa, despite his flailing campaign, and can ultimately coalesce enough conservative voters, anti-Romney alternative voters in South Carolina, his campaign's on. That's the end of January. Right. But if by February 1st he hasn't done that, he's dead.
But you know what I found interesting is the way that he talked about immigration. Texas, obviously, a big border state. It didn't play particularly well with conservative members of the Republican Party. But he has, you know, I would say a more, what, liberally democratic view of immigration than perhaps some of his counterparts in his party.
Marty, never use the word liberal in the same sentence with a Texas Republican.
Uh-oh. I blew it, right?
You're exactly right. I think it's a more sensitive and sophisticated, frankly, understanding. Many border governors often do understand, not always, but often do understand the complexity of this immigration issue, and governors from Texas historically have. Governor George Bush did. And Rick Perry actually does. He basically has supported and actively supported the idea and signed a bill to give in-state tuition to the children of illegal immigrants who are here. That plays fine in Texas. We understand this. We live with folks down on the border and all across the state. But, man, what Perry has found out is among Tea Party types in Iowa and South Carolina and Northwest Florida, that's not very popular. So it's almost for the, and I'll use the word liberal here,
okay,
for liberal Texans, the Democrats, the few that remain, it's as if poor Perry is getting beat up for the one thing he did right in the last decade.
Well, that's fascinating. This is a bit of a gossipy question, but what is the bad blood between Rick Perry and George W. Bush. I almost forgot his name. Yeah.
What's the bad blood about? He's looking better and better every day compared to what we have. That is a long and complicated history. There are two significant moments, I think, and they're really not very significant, but they're significant in this strain. Perry has always seen himself in George Bush's shadow, and so that's a problem. Bush was a very popular governor as he rose. When Bush was governor, Rick Perry, who was lieutenant governor, tried to get his brother-in-law appointed to a judgeship, and Bush refused to do it. Well, that didn't make Perry very happy. Then in 1996, in the lieutenant governor race, where Rick Perry was running for lieutenant governor, Bush was running for re-election as governor before his presidential race. Basically, the short version is that Karl Rove, who was George Bush's advisor, basically mandated his media arrangement, that Perry not run a particular commercial, that he's going to run another commercial. That was awful lot of overreaching by Carl, but it was a lot of resentment that was built up there. It's grown worse and worse over time, and what Perry has found out is that some of the things that George Bush did as president are not particularly helpful to the candidate. I mean, Bush spent a lot of money in Texas, and he spent arguably a lot of money and never vetoed anything as president. And so Perry has politically had to distance himself if he wanted some of this Tea Party support. That's really what's behind us.
Well, the interesting weeds there, and that's Wayne Slater, our second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He's senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News and has covered Texas for years, knows how things work in Texas, and we are talking about the candidacy of Rick Perry. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me try Stephen from Allentown, who just called us up. And Stephen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Stephen. Yes, I just had a question following up about Perry's Chicago-style favoritism politics. One thing that I've read was that nuclear waste site was built in West Texas that a donor had built. And I was wondering how that has affected the economy, because I know some of the environmentalists were concerned because it was very close to the watershed.
Well, Stephen, thanks for the call. Let me see if Wayne Slater can answer your question. Wayne?
Well, it hasn't affected the economy in any particular way, except that the owner of the nuclear waste dump sites made a lot of money. That's a guy named Harold Simmons, a Dallas billionaire, a big campaign contributor to the governor. And basically, he's gotten approval from Perry appointees to build and to begin to store this nuclear waste. Economically, even the community itself in West Texas, Andrews County, a very small rural community, as often is the case, wanted this project because it meant a few jobs in their area. Now, environmentally, it is potentially a nightmare. Environmentalists say, look, I mean, because of a variety of things, which I won't get into in terms of the contracts and leases and so forth, this is nuclear waste that could be there for, obviously, thousands of years, and the potential of it leaking into the Ogallala Aquifer, which is a giant aquifer that I think feeds five or six states, is there. Now, the nuclear waste the site and the state agency claims, nope, it's safe. It's a matter of significant contention. But in this case, that nuclear waste depository is operating.
Stephen, thanks for the call. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Now, Wayne, this week, Rick Perry both introduced a flat tax proposal, an optional flat tax proposal of 20%. But then he also revived this bogus birther issue and made some references to Donald Trump, seeming to sort of throw this flat tax proposal, which I think he was trying to be serious about, and I think raising questions about how serious he really is in this bid for the presidency.
See, you put your finger exactly on the problem. That was the flat tax, flat earth proposal, I think, or a combination. And it really demonstrates how undisciplined this campaign has been. It started from at zero, went to 60 very quickly. He got in late. He didn't really have policy initiatives. And they basically let Rick Perry go out and be Rick Perry, the Rick Perry who really says things in Texas. Much of what he said in this campaign would cause him no problems in Texas, but really misunderstanding a national audience. He did step on his message. He's tried to try to move back on jobs. And I've been amazed, frankly, at their failure to do what fundamentally they need to do. Rick Perry's strength is to talk about jobs in the economy. And what he's been talking about is birtherism and immigration and, frankly, anything else except that issue. That's the measure of a campaign that was not ready for prime time. They brought in some new people, including George W. Bush's top guy and the campaign guy in the 2000, top operations guy in the 2000 race. They hope they can put things together. It's not over, Marty, but it's a heck of a hill he's got to climb if he's going to climb it.
Well, let me get another caller, and this is looks like Tim from New Jersey joining us on Radio Times. And, Tim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Obviously, we know about the 999 flat tax. I know Perry has talked about a flat tax as well. I'd like to know some more details about that because everybody talks about the sales tax being X amount, but they also forget about the state tax on top of that. So it's not just in the case of Kane 9%, it's 9 plus the state tax, which in some cases it's 9%, so that's 18% sales tax. You need more granularity on the flat tax.
No,
what
right.
is it with Perry?
Well, and Kane's is different from Perry's, but let me see if Wayne can spell that out anymore. Can you put any gristle on that?
Yeah, he basically, the caller is exactly right, but he's really talking about the Kane tax, which would indeed add a national sales tax on top of the state sales tax. And in some states like Texas and perhaps Philadelphia and elsewhere, Pennsylvania and elsewhere, in some cities you might end up paying 18, 17, 18, 19%. Perry's plan, and that's right, that's basically what Keynes would do. It's a flat percentage that you would pay on your income, but you would find with almost all deductions, including your home mortgage deduction, eliminated. But what it would do is put on this sales tax and a corporate sales tax and so forth. Perry's plan does not have a sales tax increase component. What it is a flat tax, 20% of your income, that's what you pay. It maintains some deductions like your home mortgage and a charitable giving. But what it also does, which I think is both its saving grace and its and the problem, at least in the minds of some conservatives, is it gives you an option.
Right.
If you don't like the flat tax idea, you just go with the system the way it is. The problem with that is, while it sounds even-handed, what it does is really offers a choice to very wealthy people to go to the flat tax. The rest of us won't know what to do and may very well have to stay where we are if we have certain deductions that help us. It essentially is, like all flat taxes, a shift to fundamentally shifting the burden to middle-income and lower-middle-income people, no matter how you shake and bake it. Perry's tried to improve that, but that's still a component of his plan.
Makes the system less progressive, right?
Oh, absolutely, and that's what a flat tax does. Right now, progressive income tax, if you put a flat tax in to eliminate the sort of marginal differences in sales tax, income tax, then it is less progressive. Less progressive means This is another way to call this. This is the Steve Forbes never has to pay taxes again plan. under the Perry plan, Warren Buffett would see his income tax go to about 0.2% because it would exempt capital gains and dividends taxes on those kind of things. That's where these guys make their money.
Let me get John from Connecticut to join our conversation. And, John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
David Brooks' column the other day mentioned that Perry appeals to the what he called alternative reality Republicans, those who don't believe in evolution or climate change or that Obama was born in America. And I wondered whether your guests can speak to that, whether those are real beliefs of Perry's or they're just political stuff. And I'll hang up and take your call.
Now, John, thanks for the call. Wayne, can you get in the mind of Rick Perry?
Yeah, that's always a danger. You know, I mean, a presumptuous and dangerous thing. But I think what I can say is these were not issues that have been particularly important and that Perry has articulated in years past. I've covered him for 20 years, his full 10 years as governor. He didn't care about climate change several years ago. He only relatively recently began more expressive about his religious faith and so forth. He was not an active opponent of evolution. These are all relatively new, at least public stands by Rick Perry. Now you can say that he has, like Paul on the road to Tarsus, found truth and found that these are valid things to believe. Another interpretation is that he sees those as very strong political magnets, because this race remains, no matter what you think of these polls, remains a Romney versus the alternative to Romney race. Kane is on top right now. The expectation is he will begin to fall. The question is whether some of these folks, including the alternative reality conservatives, and frankly, just honest conservatives who believe that government has become too big, will go to another candidate, ideally Perry. They'll either remain divided or they'll coalesce around a single alternative to Romney. We don't know what's going to happen.
Well, Wayne, a final question before we have to say goodbye and then get our third guest in. But word is that Rick Perry is considering skipping some of these debates. Now, there are a lot of them. He hasn't done particularly well. Do you see that as a sign of some weakness in his candidacy?
Boy, it looks like it. I mean, I talked a couple of days ago again to the campaign spokesman Ray Sullivan, who told me that we're going to skip some of these. It looks weak. If you do lousy and then you say I won't do this anymore, you look weak. If he can debate as he's going to on November 9th and do fairly well and then skip some, then I think that would be better. In fact, I could see some other candidates following his lead and maybe skipping a few, because there are just so many out there.
Well, Wayne Slater, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Anytime, Marty.
And Wayne Slater, senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, and getting us up to speed on politics, Texas style, and the Republican candidacy of Rick Perry. We have Margaret Tolliv waiting in the wings, and we'll be talking about the fact that the president has been out on the road, and we'll be talking about what he's up to. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
To protect the life of a dog who is being abused, the hero of Scott Spencer's novel, Man in the Woods, gets into a fight and accidentally kills the man abusing the dog. In shock, he thinks,
how can this be happening? And he wishes, suddenly, fervently, that there was a God.
We'll hear from Scott Spencer on the next Fresh Air.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Navigating the Medicare maze. Time is running out for seniors to adjust their benefits. And just in time for Halloween, the pseudoscience of a zombie brain. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. President Obama was back out on the campaign trail this week. He announced a student loan relief program and a program providing assistance for underwater homeowners. He criticized Congress for not passing his American Jobs Act and unveiled a new chant, "We Can't Wait." Well, joining us to talk about the White House is Margaret Tolov, and she's White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. And Margaret, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you back. And the president's poll numbers up and down, but you know, nothing dramatic in the last couple of months. Is the White House worried about his candidacy and a second term?
The White House is working very hard to try to contain what are not great numbers heading into a re-election year and to make sure they don't go worse. And you see him in Western states where, you know, he could count on support in 2008 and is not counting on that support, not taking that support for granted now. Yeah, of course they are concerned.
And interestingly, and I think not surprisingly, a student relief program, he got a lot of support 4 years ago from young people. Is that, do you think, in part to help get young people back in on his side of the campaign?
Absolutely. What you're seeing with this "We Can't Wait" slogan that they're rolling out, well, there's a few different levels of politics that you're seeing, but one is that many of these are fairly targeted measures. These are things that he doesn't need Congress's votes to do. And so sort of by nature, they're limited in how many people they reach and how much of a relief, you know, they can equate to for each of these people. But if there's 36 million people with student loans and 6 million people who might be able to take advantage of it, you know, it's a fraction of the total people. But if you are a person with student loans, you may hear what he's saying and say, "Oh, isn't that great? President Obama is trying to take care of people like me with student loans." And so part of the calculation is that he will get sort of a bang for his buck politically on the message of, "I'm trying to help homeowners who are underwater. I'm trying to help people who are, you know, crushed under student loan debt." The number of people who may actually get assistance and how much assistance that'll be is inherently a smaller number than the people the message is intended to reach.
But these are legitimate issues, it seems to me. And when you look at some of the student debt that that young people have, and the fact that millions of people are underwater when it comes to their mortgage payments, and this is holding back the economy in many ways.
Certainly. So in the student loan programs that he's rolling out, they affect, there's sort of two different parts to that plan, and one part of the plan is theoretically applicable to just shy of 6 million people, and another part expedites some relief for about 1.6 million loan holders. And in the case of the first, the larger number, this is a really specific set of people who have two specific concurrent loans that they're paying off, and if you fall into that category, you can consolidate it into one federal loan and maybe shave about a half of a percent off. So you're talking, for some people, about a couple hundred dollars in savings per month, and that's great,
yeah,
right? And who wouldn't take the
sure
relief if they could get it?
Sure.
But if you're, you know, 30 million other people and you're thinking, "Oh, this is great, this is going to apply to me," when you get to the fine print, you know, it may not. And what the White House has calculated is it's better to help some people than no people, and we hope that we get credit from the broader swath of students and young adults and even older adults who are, you know, for years later paying off these loans.
Now, he's using something called the executive branch actions. Obviously, he's run into a wall with Congress. What kind of authority does the president have then to make these happen?
Well, you know, you can do a lot with rulemaking and policymaking at the agency level. The trouble is when you need to come up with new appropriations, right, money that you don't have, or when you need to come up with changes to the law that the way statutes are constructed require congressional approval. I think, you know, what you're seeing Republicans make the counterargument of this week is, well, great, if he can, you know, So we can't wait. Okay, then don't wait.
Right? Oh, is that the counter slogan then?
Well, I mean, no, it's not officially, but it is. When you're talking about, the White House has the authority to do some stuff without Congress. But when they decide to use that authority and how much they decide to promote it are political questions, right? Mm-hmm. So if he could have done this 6 months ago, why didn't he do it 6 months ago? That was a question that came up on a call with reporters and administration officials earlier this week on the We Can't Wait plan. And the explanation, I can't remember if this was in the case of the mortgages or the student loans, was that it takes some time for the administration to figure out how to expedite stuff or how to carve out changes in their policies. But, you know, what the president is trying to do is to use this We Can't Wait, you know, mantra to draw attention to Congress and to say, Congress isn't acting, so we can't, you know, we're not going to wait for them to not act. The flip side is, if there are things the administration can be doing to make things better for people, mm-hmm. shouldn't they already be doing that? And then the double flip side, right, is there going to be a blowback from Congress? Are Democrats going to get irritated that the president is making lawmakers the boogeyman? I mean, you know, his approval rating might be at 40-some percent, but theirs is at like 9 or 10%, right?
Exactly.
So there are, this is sort of a complex play. It's a complex play by the White House, but they sense that people are frustrated that Washington isn't getting stuff done and that the best way for mm-hmm. him to handle it is to do what he can and then say, I'd be doing more if Congress were with me.
Let me ask you, because I certainly hear the president criticizing Congress. He has called out some Republicans and made some mentions of the Republican Party, but he often criticizes Congress. And I wonder how Democrats feel about that.
They don't like it. I mean, and it depends which Democrat you are. If you're a Democrat who has got a tough reelection fight, you hear that and you don't appreciate it. If you're a Democrat who's firmly entrenched in the district where you're not going to face a primary challenge and you know you're going to win your general election, then, you know, you chalk it up to politics and you move on. But it is privately among Democrats a real source of frustration to have him turn his, you know, to make all of them the bad guys. And for the president, he ran on the spirit of bipartisanship. You know, I'm a uniter, not a divider. I'm going to change the way politics works in Washington. Every now and then, he will go after Republicans, but he keeps balancing that with his desire to show swing voters and independent voters that, you know, that he can be bipartisan, too. So mm-hmm. the White House has tried it both ways and is still trying to figure out how to proceed in the general election.
And that's Margaret Tolliv, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. And we are talking about President Obama out on the campaign trail and continuing his fight with Congress. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Margaret, though, I'm wondering whether it is a different President Obama after the summer and the debt showdown with the Republicans. Then in early September, he had his jobs speech, the American Jobs Act. And he seems like a slightly different President Obama. Am I reading too much into this?
That he's been more assertive or
more assertive. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Again, it's still sort of pregame. I mean, he is in reelection mode, but until January, February, you know, late winter, early spring, when you really see the Republican primary sort of consolidate itself and sort itself out, between now and then, he's got some room to practice and try different tactics. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what they're doing. And part of it is the coinciding of all of the stuff, the debt debate, the Jobs Act bill, with these Occupy Wall Street protests and the administration's recognition that while they maybe would like to keep the protesters at arm's length, the you know, specific cause of the protests at arm's length, that they need to acknowledge the wave of, you know, the public frustration, that we're not mad as hell, not going to take it anymore. That's something that they need to acknowledge, perhaps by him saying, I'm mad too, and, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not going to just lie down and blah, blah, blah. So, but they, again, are trying to calibrate precisely how should he respond to that. You know, we're basically on the spectrum of embracing the protesters versus saying, what do they believe in? What's their cause anyway? That somewhere in between there is the right place for him,
and choosing
for him
the,
to be.
And choosing the words very carefully. Now, this gets a bit into the weeds, but he did unveil this American Jobs Act. It's a $447 billion bill that would be tax cuts for employers and employees, infrastructure programs, money for states to hire teachers and emergency responders. Now, the Republicans in Congress basically said no. You know, no way. We're not gonna even address this. But it seems that the White House is positioning itself to use that against Congress and perhaps even against Republicans in Congress for political reasons. And again, I'd be curious about how you see the politics of this American Jobs Act.
Well, Marty, what's the downside for them?
Well,
if they pressure Congress and they get what they want, they get what they wanted. If they pressure Congress knowing that they're not going to get what they want, but that their argument resonates with their base and enough swing voters, then, you know, how have they lost? The White House's posture going into this, although you're right, of course, that the Republicans did say we are not going to pass this plan whole cloth, they didn't reject out hand every aspect of the plan. They like the tax relief.
Of course.
It's the infrastructure spending and the money that would go to, you know, basically unionized workers in education, and law enforcement, and stuff that they're not embracing. And the question is there any room in the middle, or is the only thing they're poised to do sign off on the tax relief? And if that's the case, will Democrats go along with it? Now, the president will take what he can get, but you still need to put votes together. You know.
Do you think Congress or members of Congress, do they fear President Obama?
You know, that's a great question. I think that they are balancing, when you're a member of Congress, you're always balancing your real boss, which is your constituents, against the executive and how much authority he marshals in the public eye. And what the president has been trying to do by going out on the hustings to promote the American Jobs Act is to rally the public around him so that he has leverage to scare Congress.
Mm.
How much that's working depends to a large degree on what district you're in, what state you're in, what part of the country you're in, what constituencies you represent, and also on the president's overall poll numbers.
Right. And those poll numbers seem to be just how people feel about the economy?
They certainly, you know, track with the economic condition. They are, and historically when you look at presidential elections, it's just not a position that you want to be in, and the unemployment numbers are not a position that he wants to be in. He's in a difficult situation economically, and it shows in the polls.
Yeah, and as the Republicans, you know, duke it out to for the presidential nomination, who do you think the Obama administration fears or is most worries will be the candidate?
Whoever has the best chance to beat President Obama.
Yeah, I mean, is that's in the Hall of Mirrors? That's how they see it.
It's absolutely pragmatic. It is. I don't think that I have no reason to believe. I have not heard any administration official say that they think any of the Republicans are better debaters or have, experience in a way that would overshadow the president's experience. This is a question of the economy is voters' driving concern. The president says it, his advisors say it, everybody on the Obama team says it, and so it's a twofold question. It is which Republican candidates can best convince voters that they have experience with business and economics and budgets, and once you get through the Republican primary, who poses the greatest threat to President Obama in a general election?
But I'm assuming they are paying very close attention to what's going on the other side.
Right now, you heard President Obama say on the Jay Leno show,
yes,
a couple nights ago that he's waiting to see who gets voted off the island. Right?
Yes,
and that
exactly.
Got a big round of laughter from the audience. But of course, his team is paying attention. I mean, why would you not pay attention? Mm. Why would you not pay attention? First of all, it's been a really interesting primary process to watch. But second of all, you know, his team, the people who advise him and who consider how different states play out and the national strategy. They want to know who they're dealing with. How do these people respond to questions? What are their policy positions? How do they interact with a live audience? How do they interact with each other? What do they say about President Obama? And these early months provide a lot of clues for all of us.
And it sounds like for the president, he doesn't have to worry about a primary, obviously. So his focus is really on the general election and on those independent voters or those voters that perhaps in the middle that have not made up their mind.
He doesn't have to worry about a primary. He has to worry about the economy. Like, that's his opponent, mm-hmm. right? In many ways, more than the Republican challenger, that's his opponent. And the White House has been watching this Eurozone crisis very closely, because what happens with Greece and the way the Europeans handle it has global implications on the economy and has direct implications on the U.S. economy and, as a result, the 2012 presidential election.
Well, it must be interesting to watch it from your vantage point, Margaret Tolliff.
If you're interested in politics and policy and the confluence of the two, there are so many factors at hand, the super committee, the debt ceiling debate, but more broadly, the U.S. economy and the global economy.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks.
You're very welcome. And that's Margaret Tolliff. She is White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, the three of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Catching up on a bunch of news this week, and it's been a very busy week when it comes to national political news. Margaret Tolliff with Bloomberg News. We also talked with Wayne Slater, senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, and began things off with Paul Taylor. He's the executive vice president of the Pew Research Center, and we got him to weigh in on the new study out this week from the Congressional Budget Office. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.